Let us turn to Acts chapter 27. Acts 27. We read from verse 1. And when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. And entering into a ship of Atramyttium, we launched, meaning to sail by the coasts of Asia. One Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself. And when we had launched from thence, we sailed under Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lycia. And there the centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. And when we had sailed slowly many days, and scarce were come over Cnidus, the wind not suffering us, we sailed under Crete, over against Salmone, and hardly passing it, came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh unto was the city of Lasia. There was once an American artist named Thomas Cole, and he is famous for four paintings, a series of four paintings entitled The Voyage of Life. And in these four paintings, he depicts the four stages of human life: childhood, youth, manhood, and old age. Each picture is of a voyager who travels in a boat on a river. In each painting, accompanied by a guardian angel, the voyager rides the boat on the river of life. The landscape, corresponding to the seasons of the year, plays a major role in telling the story. The one that depicts childhood shows an infant who is in a rich green landscape, gliding along on his boat with the guardian angel. As a youth, the boy takes control of the boat and aims for a shining castle in the sky. In manhood, the adult relies on prayer and faith to sustain him through rough waters and a threatening landscape. Finally, the man becomes old, and the angel guides him to heaven across the waters of eternity. Now, these four paintings by Thomas Cole were popular in their day, painted in 1842, and it was a time of revival and great spiritual blessing in America. And many Christians saw in these paintings an allegory, really, of life and the Christian life, and they were often used for the purposes of illustration. Well, here in Acts chapter 27, Paul begins his voyage to Rome. And what happens at this stage is like one of the paintings of his voyage of life: manhood, because relying on prayer and faith to sustain him, he is helped through. And it is just like that for us too. It's an apt picture, because life is like a voyage, sailing on uncertain waters, a certain ultimate destination, But so much happens on the way that can be very challenging and very trying. But this stage of things, the first leg of Paul's voyage to Rome, is not so hard, and it was surely given him to prepare him for what was to come, the storm and the shipwreck later. But at this stage, we see the Lord being very thoughtful and very kind to him, as he is to us, and granting him some wonderful tokens and help for the beginning of this great journey that will culminate in Rome. He must leave Caesarea for Rome for his hearing before Caesar. And the first step of his voyage, or the first leg, is in verses 1 to 8. They all go in a coasting vessel, and they go from place to place, recorded here. And after 500 miles and 14 days, the vessel puts in at Myra, a southern coast of Asia Minor, to the east of Rhodes. And there, verse 6, the centurion found a ship of Alexandria, that's the chief city of Egypt, sailing into Italy, and he put us therein. The first part was only in a local vessel going from place to place, and he was looking for a ship that would go all the way to Rome. And in the port of Alexandria there was a grain ship, and these ships that carried cargo carried passengers as well. And so, finding that this one was going all the way to Italy — Egypt, you see, was the granary of the world at that time, and it was taking its cargo of grain to Rome, and there was room — and so they all get put in this ship, and it's this one that gets caught up in the storm and gets shipwrecked. But for now, let's look at the first stage of the voyage, and let us see Paul and what he knew of the Lord's presence with him, just like on our voyage of life, and how that we can know and be assured that the Lord will be mindful of us. And there were two great things that the Lord kindly gave to Paul that would have made all the difference to things at this stage of the journey, the voyage. First of all, blessed assurance. And secondly, comfortable guidance. These twin blessings are the blessings that you and I can expect from the Lord as well. In the uncertainty of the voyage, relying on prayer and faith, and the Lord's gracious presence and help. Let's look first of all at the blessed assurance that was given to Paul. Verse 1, and when it was determined that we should sail into Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners unto one named Julius, a centurion, and so on. Now, the blessed assurance was this, that Paul could be sure that he was in the Lord's way. Difficult though this was, and momentous though the outcome would be as he reached Rome and had to have his hearing before Caesar himself, he was in the Lord's way. Because you see, there was the Lord's purpose here. Look at verse 1. It was determined that we should sail into Italy. Determined by whom? Well, Festus, of course. Remember? He said, thou hast appealed unto Caesar, unto Caesar thou shalt go. So Festus had determined it. Ah, but dear friends, there is a higher determination that always operates, higher than the merely human. And in chapter 23, verse 11, do you remember? Right back then, the Lord had told Paul, Be of good cheer. As thou hast testified of me in Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome. It was God's purpose that Paul should go to Rome. Determined by Festus, he thought he was sending a prisoner to Nero, as this prisoner had exercised his right as a Roman citizen. He thought that. Little did he think that God had already determined it before Festus had. And dear friends, this is our outlook, isn't it? People determine things concerning us, but it doesn't start or stop there. It's God's determination that is above all that. That's the one that counts. The Lord's determination. The first cause in everything. Human decisions are only subject to the government of God. And they're only by His permission and means of working. Ever remember Proverbs 19 verse 21. There are many devices in a man's heart. Nevertheless, the counsel of the Lord, that shall stand. You see, we are not at the mercy of people who have authority and who can make decisions on our behalf and can ensure that things are carried out concerning us. We are not at their mercy. They are at God's disposal. And we are at the Lord's mercy. It was determined. And the great comfort Paul had was, he was not in the hands of Festus or the Roman government. He was in the hands of the Lord and the government of heaven. And the fact that he was going on this voyage to Rome, part of his voyage of life, was that he is in the Lord's way. And it's all part of God's purpose. It is meant to be. And that's a great comfort to know, that whatever happens, though it might not seem clear to us, and though we might not be able to trace the outcome in the end, where it's leading, how it will finally turn out, to be in the place of obedience, walking with God, we are perfectly safe. Dear friends, it's the comfort of knowing that we are in the Lord's way. That's the assurance. Psalm 37, verse 23. The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord. And he, the Lord, delighteth in his way. You see how minute and particular that is? Every step that you take, ordered by God ultimately, he's in control. And he delights in your way, delights in the way you're going. If you seek to go in his way, you've got the pleasure of God, the favour of God, the smile of God upon you. It's a blessed assurance that even though it's a hard way to go, even though it's uncomfortable, uncertain, mysterious, trying, all these things are real to flesh and blood. We feel it very much. But the thing is, if God is in charge and over all, if we're in his way, pleasing to him, that's our great comfort and blessed assurance. It doesn't even exempt Paul from the dangers of a storm or the perils of a shipwreck. But, as he says in verse 23, when it's beginning to happen, there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, fear not, Paul, thou must be brought before Caesar, and God hath given thee all them that sail with thee. That's for later. But what a comfort. God, whose I am and whom I serve. Always get that the right way round. It's our belonging to him before our serving him. Whose I am. It's that love relationship and then the labour of love. It's not whom I serve first and then whose I am. It's relationship before service. And Paul, therefore, as we can know that wonderful experience of love for the Lord and doing his will. So, blessed assurance, it was determined. Divine determination above all, the great first cause behind every second cause and every subsidiary thing that is happening. That's why Calvinism, so called, you see, the doctrine of God's sovereignty in the realm of salvation is something that obtains to every aspect of things, doesn't it? Every doctrine, every experience, everything in life. The vision of the sovereignty of God, that sense of God and his greatness, total control, warm and loving Heavenly Father who is doing all things for me and my life and circumstances, all in his hands. Nothing can stir without him doing it. Nothing can give itself a birth without God being the originator of it. Nothing can happen to me, come against me, fall out in any way, but that God is the first cause and the author, the prime mover. It was determined. Blessed assurance. It means that man isn't in charge. Circumstances are not what's governing things. Unfortunate occurrences, unlucky outcomes, all that kind of thing. The fictitious powers of chance and fortune I defy. My life's minutest circumstance is subject to his eye. And if the minutest, then the greatest as well. It was determined that we should sail into Italy. How different from Jonah's voyage, Paul's voyage is, isn't it? The problem with Jonah was he was out of the way, wasn't he? In Jonah chapter 1 verse 3 we read that he fled from the Lord to go to Tarshish, and it's actually put like this: from the presence of the Lord. Doesn't mean, of course, absolutely. You can never get out of God's presence. But it means from the comfortable sense that he was in the Lord's way, from the Lord's approving presence. He was on his way to Tarshish, and he went down to Joppa, to the harbour, found a ship going to Tarshish. How the devil can smooth our way, can't he, when we're backsliding? How the devil can work in providence to make everything fall out, and even encourage us to kid ourselves that maybe we're still in the Lord's way, if it's all working out very happily. But again, twice in that one verse, fled to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord, took a ship going to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. And if we do that, nothing will go right. We'll lose that blessed assurance. We'll be living in denial, but we'll know that we're out of the way, and we'll soon discover things not going right. It wasn't long before Jonah found that, was it? The storm and the being told to pray to his God and the confession that he was a prophet of the Lord, which made heaven and earth, and the fear that came upon the mariners. And then they're having to throw him overboard and all that kind of thing. Nothing will go right. Now, do you pray about everything? Especially every change, every decision you must make. Is it what you want or what the Lord wants? You see, keep in the way. And make sure that by prayer and careful walking in God's way, you're in the center of his will. Because if we sincerely want to be in the Lord's way, he'll not allow us to go out of it. Those words in Isaiah 41 verse 13. I, the Lord, will hold thy right hand saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. Holding our hand like a father, his child, so that we don't step off the pavement into the road and into danger. He'll hold our hand, fear not, I'll help you, I'll keep you in the right way. By prayer and careful keeping close to God, he has hold of us. The thing is, even with Jonah, eventually it came right, didn't it? God was so sovereign there that despite him fleeing, going in the opposite direction, and all the disasters that came about, God brought him back. And the word of the Lord came to him the second time, go to Nineveh, and he went. So God was even above recalcitrant Jonah in all his rebellion and running away from God's commission. God was sovereign there. Even a man of God at his worst won't permanently forfeit that blessed assurance, because God keeps us and he restores us. But how much better, like Paul here, to be submissive and humble and blessed with the peace of God, because he's in the Lord's way, the gracious, wise, divine determination. Even though the waters are rough on the voyage of life, we're kept safe if we're in the right way. So, blessed assurance. And the other thing here we can add to it from these verses is comfortable guidance. See the way the Lord guided Paul and provided for him here, right at the beginning, to show him tokens of his love. The Lord delights to give these tokens, these little signs, these providential signs that he's with us and that we need not fear. And he gave them to Paul, typical of what he will do for us. What were they? Well, one thing was beloved friends to go with him. It's there, look, in verse 1. When it was determined that we should sail into Italy. We. That's Luke writing. So Luke is with Paul. He'd been with him all this while since Jerusalem. Throughout all this, he was the eyewitness of all these hearings before Felix, Festus, Agrippa. He was reporting it, writing it all down meticulously. And now he's going to accompany Paul on the voyage to Rome. That's why, you see, you get all these place names, don't you? Adramatium and Sidon, and then Cyprus, Cilicia, Pamphylia, Myra, Lycia, and Salmone, and so on. All these because Luke is keeping a journal, and he's guaranteeing the historical accuracy of this voyage. And this has impressed biblical scholars, even to the point of unbelieving New Testament scholars in the 19th century, reckoning that Luke must have made mistakes because the Bible can't be relied upon to be accurate in matters of geography and history and geology and all the rest of it. And they went and saw these places for themselves. And they found, lo and behold, everyone was just as Luke had recorded it. And it's convinced them of the truth, the trustworthiness of the word of God. We're not surprised at that. But here is dear Luke. And of course, what is Luke? Well, he's more than a Christian friend. He's the beloved physician. Someone to meet Paul's needs, attend to Paul's needs in that way. It would be great, wouldn't it, if we were in Paul's place to have a Christian doctor with us for this long voyage? Tremendous! Well, that was no accident. The Lord was thinking of Paul. And there was another great friend as well in verse 2. One Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. Now that man was a great blessing He'd been with Paul all the while, like Luke. And you find, by the time you get to Colossians chapter 4, verse 10, which letter Paul has written from his confinement in Rome, awaiting his hearing before Nero, "Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, saluteth you." Now, Aristarchus from Thessalonica was one of these choice men who could attach himself to somebody and be such a fast friend. And he was willing to share Paul's voyage, and he was willing to be there in Rome and to actually be there in the prison with Rome. Some say, whether it's true or not, can't be sure, but some say that he actually offered his services as Paul's slave in order to attend to him and be with him and then be in the prison with him. Well, you can't go further than that, can you, in friendship and devotedness? But whatever it was, there is a tremendous bond of friendship and love from Aristarchus toward Paul. And the Lord knows how much human friendship and support mean to us, doesn't he? And when it's right, he grants us special friends. And if Aristarchus loves Paul and will do anything he can for him, the Lord does infinitely more so and will do anything that's right for him. And so Paul can see in Aristarchus a token of the Lord's love and provision. Luke and Aristarchus, these two great friends, who do you need more, really, humanly speaking? It's tremendous, isn't it, to have these alongside you as you're going to Rome on this voyage. Well, the Lord grants that to us, doesn't he? It's a very wonderful thing to have Christian friends, isn't it? And the older you go, the older we grow, the more we come to value Christian friends, don't we? We all have our special ones, as well as everybody else in the faith that we know, but certain ones in particular, the Lord has blessed us with them. And oh, they're treasures, aren't they? They really are. And they've proved their faithfulness and stalwartness when we've perhaps been in trouble and in great need. The Lord has loved us through them and cared for us and supported us and helped us. And we've seen the Lord in them, haven't we? And thanked God for them. Luke and Aristarchus. Paul's not left to himself, humanly speaking. But then, not only beloved friends, but kind treatment. Look at verse 3. "And Julius courteously entreated Paul and gave him liberty to go unto his friends to refresh himself." Now, this Julius, we're told in verse 1, is a centurion of Augustus' band, which means he belonged to the imperial guard, the king's own men, as it were. He was charged with bringing notable prisoners to Rome who had appealed to Caesar. He had a very high and honoured position with the emperor there in Rome. And this commander of at least 100 men was there with Paul. And notice that he courteously treats Paul, allows himself at Sidon to get off the boat and go to Christian friends in Sidon to refresh himself, probably a church at Sidon. And there, probably a Roman soldier has to go with Paul, but he's allowed to meet up with these friends and be spiritually refreshed and have a lovely time together with them. Why should Julius do this? Well, because the Lord had put it in his heart to do it. You've not only got dear Christian friends like Luke and Aristarchus, you've got a non-Christian man treating Paul so considerately and so kindly. That happened to John Bunyan when he was in prison in Bedford, didn't it? He was actually allowed to go out. The jailer actually allowed him to go out overnight and spend it at home and then come back next morning, because he knew that Bunyan was so honest as a godly man that he wouldn't run away. And the Lord puts it in the hearts of even the ungodly to treat believers with kindness. I wonder if it was when it says in chapter 25, verse 23, that Paul's defense and testimony before King Agrippa was attended by chief captains. I wonder if Julius was one of them. And he'd actually listened to Paul and heard what he said and had been impressed with the man's godliness and sincerity. And so impressed, the Lord causes him to show Paul favor, like the jailer gave Joseph favor in the prison. You see, the Lord has all men's hearts in his hand, and he can turn hearts toward us, can't he, in our favor. Julius courteously entreated Paul. We're thankful for every Julius that we meet as well. Not converted people, but kind people. Common grace makes them kind to us, even though we're Christians. We can't share on the spiritual level, but nonetheless, humanly speaking, we're glad of their thoughtfulness for us. And we see in that the Lord's token of thoughtfulness. But look, here's something else. Not only beloved friends and kind treatment from an ungodly man, but, the best of all, fellowship. It's what I alluded to at the second part of verse 3. To go unto his friends to refresh himself. Now, of course, there is all the difference, isn't there, between the kindness of Julius and the fellowship of fellow Christians at Sidon. And Paul would have cherished every moment that he had with them. Even the persecutors of Christians know how much it means for Christians to have friends. That's why in these days, or when persecution officially began, they banished Christians to work in mines or on lonely islands. Remember John on the Isle of Patmos? Get them away from other Christians so they won't be strengthened and encouraged. So they'll be miserable and depressed on their own, humanly speaking. Not that they were ever on their own. The Lord was with them. But you see, Paul doesn't have to suffer that. He can meet with these dear Christians. And dear friends, there's one thing about persecution, which is what Paul was experiencing here. One thing about persecution is it binds Christians closer together. Because it's mutual suffering, isn't it? We suffer together. And probably it is that at times of persecution, mild or severe, things that would possibly keep us apart as Christians at other times, when we're all going through it, those things are forgotten, and just the fact that we're fellow Christians is enough, and it means that we come together perhaps in a new way. It does create a bond of fellowship. We need one another, never mind about our views on this or that. They can be dealt with at another time, but at such exceptional times, we need one another, don't we? And it could be that if it pleases the Lord to lead us through times of persecution in days to come, it will certainly bring about a consolidation of Christians in a way that perhaps is not usual. How often it has been the case Someone has illustrated it like this, by the sequoia or redwood trees of California. They grow to over 300 feet above ground, but they have unusually shallow root systems that reach out in all directions to capture the greatest amount of moisture. Trouble is, of course, because the roots don't go down deep and the trees are so very high, they're liable to be blown over. So what does God the Creator do? He causes them to grow in clusters. Numbers of them all together, so their roots all intermingle and grow together, so that when the fierce winds blow, because they're all rooted together, they don't fall over. And so they all keep each other upright and fast. And you see, when suffering comes, we are intertwined as believers in a new way, and we keep each other and we strengthen each other against the gales of adversity. And here you see, Luke, Aristarchus, the believers at Sidon were helping Paul, and Paul was helping them. You got this a bit in our day. We've heard a lot about the Asher's Bakery in Northern Ireland, and how that those good people who run the Asher's Bakery have fallen foul of the Diversity and Equality Commission, and are going to be taken to court because they wouldn't produce a cake with some gay slogan on it for gay people. And the bulls, Peter and Hazel Mary Bull, who ran that Christian guest house in Cornwall, and how they wouldn't allow a sodomite couple to occupy one of their rooms because their arrangement has always been married couples only for double rooms. Well, both are suffering. But recently in Northern Ireland, in Belfast, I understand, there was a meeting held at which the friends from the Asher's Bakery were there, and Mr. and Mrs. Bull were there. 700 people were present. In excess of 700 people coming to rally around these good people and take their stand together for God and for truth and for righteousness. Well, you see, it brings believers together, doesn't it? And strengthens them. And mutual suffering brings mutual fellowship and support. It's a very wonderful thing. And it might well happen more and more in the coming days. Well, that will be one good consequence of it. Christians will value one another as they've never valued them before. Against an angry, persecuting society, for what we stand for, we'll be blessed in loving and belonging to the Lord's people and all that we stand for together. And so you see, comfortable guidance. The Lord saying to Paul again and again, in this way and that way, "Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I will help thee. I will strengthen thee. I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness." So let's be on the lookout for these providential signs, these tokens for good, that the Lord is with us. He'll give them to us, and they'll be in Christ's stead to bless us and encourage us. Robert Hawker says, "It is wonderful to consider the presence of God with Paul all along. Which things are our examples, that we also may put our trust in God, who hath said, He will not leave us, nor forsake us." Paul might have said, "Well, I knew I had to go to Rome. I didn't think it would be this way. I imagined I might end up there after another missionary tour or something like that. I didn't imagine I would go as a prisoner on a dangerous voyage and endure shipwreck on the way and then be under house arrest until my hearing before Caesar and my acquittal." We never know what's ahead, do we? But as long as we have the blessed assurance of being in his way. We can have the comfortable guidance that he is with us. And we shall treasure every token, every evidence, every sweet sign of the Lord's love, and that he thinketh upon us for good. Well, may it be so for us, for the glory of his name. Let us sing together hymn 732.